We come from the land of the ice and snow, from the midnight sun, where the hot springs flow. In honor of Thor Ragnarok, what movie villain should have been Cate Blanchett?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Blofeld and Spectre, because imagine just instead of Christoph Waltz sleepwalking through the exact same villain role he's been doing for years, imagine it being Cate Blanchett.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Frank Booth, Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet.
I'm Dave with a 7, and I'm going to say Jafar from Aladdin, and they could put his song back into the movie, her song back into the movie.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with whatever that evil Polish painting's name was in Ghostbusters 2. He was Polish, right?
He is Vigo.
Vigo! He wasn't Polish. He was, like, Czech.
I'm waiting for our Polish listeners to bring some hate mail.
I'm Polish. I should know these things. I always identified with him. I thought that there was some sort of connection between he and I for that reason, but...
No wonder we're one star on Polish iTunes.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 188 and it's Tuesday, October 31st. Happy Halloween. And it's also a very surprising anniversary. On this day in 1994, TLC released the Creep single. It would be their first number one hit.
Spooky.
Not even the best song of the 90s called Creep.
Wow.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Here comes David with the Radiohead tape.
Way to take a huge shit right on the beginning of the podcast. Come on.
I'm sorry. TLC. I went to a costume party the other day. Where there was a lot of money on the line, and everybody from my office dressed like Wes Anderson characters, and we were beat by three girls dressed as TLC, and so I got nothing but hate for TLC right now.
Wow.
I would have done that exact same thing if I was in that position.
Which Tenenbaum? You were one of the young Tenenbaums?
I was the laziest of the Wes Anderson characters. I just went to the Adidas store and bought a red tracksuit, which is fully refundable. Ari Tenenbaum. Yes.
Well, you had to go to an Adidas store. That's a lift.
The Adidas store is two blocks from my office.
All right, you are the laziest.
There was a Bill Murray profile in the New Yorker where they were with him on the backstage at Seth Meyers, and one of the production assistants came up to him and was like, "Hey, do you remember me? I paid one of the Chaz's kids." He like reconnected with Bill Murray. Now he's a PA on Seth Meyers.
Bill Murray was like, "I have no idea who you are."
It didn't matter because Bill Murray loves strangers.
That's true. He loves them as much as if they were veteran Tenenbaums. All right, before we start this week's show, David has a stern message for all of you.
Leave us some goddamn reviews.
Thank you.
People
and
have
Halloween.
Left us some goddamn reviews before.
I know. Asterisk, if you've left us a goddamn review, thank you. We love you.
Well, and if it's in Polish iTunes, Polish, please let us know. I'm dying to hear what's going on in that iTunes.
And now on to our Halloween episode.
Wait, the Polish listeners should know that I have spent the last hour before we recorded this mixing two Polish films into my top 25 of the year. So,
man, viral marketing right here.
Keep the daggers down.
On to our Polish Halloween episode. Sure,
for some reason, Stranger Things is now a Halloween thing. The second season debuted last Friday. It had a ton of hype. Apparently, people in my office had barb glasses sent to them. So Netflix is all in because, even though we don't know how many people have watched it, it's pretty fair to call it a legitimate hit. I was at a bar last weekend here in North Carolina, and they were advertising their Stranger Wings. As in,
oh
like,
my God.
Hot wings.
I know. I have to straight up disagree with you right at the beginning of this segment.
Whoa.
I don't think we can call this a hit. I've been thinking a lot about this, and based on talking to people and seeing reactions to the stories that people have been putting out, I think it's a little hot air. I wonder. I really wonder if.
But what's okay, the but difference?
You're talking about the quality of the show.
No, I'm whereas... not. No, I'm not. I'm talking about activity. I'm talking about analytical activity. You know, we work on the web, so we can see who's talking about what in a more data-driven way. And I'm talking about hearing from different people with, like, the stories that they put out there about Stranger Things and the engagement that they get through that. I wonder, because we don't know, you know, Netflix doesn't share information. And I haven't heard a lot of people I know personally talking about Stranger Things. I wonder if it's as big a hit as it... as the Listen. Marketing would suggest. Marketing-wise, this is like a Marvel movie for
sure,
Netflix.
Sure, nothing is as big a hit as the marketing suggests.
I certainly reserve your right to question these things. I think we should all be questioning these things when it comes to Netflix and their secret numbers. I am having a very different anecdotal experience in that literally everyone on my feed will not shut up about this fucking show. It's like the new Christmas for
me. You're following
I don't
press
celebrate
people.
It, and I don't understand it. And,
press people love Stranger Things because they are feeding into the marketing, but real people
and
might,
the traffic,
might not.
Well, the traffic that I've seen, at least on the website where I work, is enormous.
Ours is pretty big.
Things.
Not Game of Thrones big, but big.
Yeah, I mean, I think Patches makes a really interesting point in that Netflix can create the illusion of a hit out of hot air. But in at least from what I've seen, and that is by no way or means definitive, it does seem like that is based in reality, at least to a certain extent.
I have heard people in real life who are not film critics in any way talk about being excited to watch Stranger Things.
Okay, okay. I take it back. Well, I mean, maybe everyone
didn't binge
it this
weekend. You don't have to take
it back.
I mean, there's no one can prove this argument one way or another.
Right. It's weird to put it out over Halloween weekend.
Ladies and gentlemen, Reed Hastings!
Exclusive reveal on this podcast of Stranger Things' actual viewership.
Yeah, it's a hit. It's a hit, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Reed.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I'll take your word for it, Reed Hastings. Thanks for joining the show.
All right, so
is Polish zombie Reed Hastings.
So does the show deserve the level of hype that Netflix has gotten? It probably not. But is Stranger Things 2, as they insist on calling it, is it any good?
It's definitely a movie sequel. I'll give them Stranger Things 2 because both the original Stranger Things and this second season are, you know, 2-hour movies stretched over 9 episodes of television. And it's written by, you know, the Duffer brothers are movie makers at heart. That's where they came from, the indie world. And they ended up kind of landing on M. Night Shyamalan's Wayward Pines TV show eons ago now. And then they got the Stranger Things deal because they wanted to make a new movie. And then they sold it as a TV show. And it feels like a really, really long movie. But to the detriment of the actual movie. In this case, Stranger Things 2 is almost exactly like Stranger Things 1. It has a really long first act, which means the first 3 or 4 episodes, basically nothing happens. But if you're really into the characters, you might like it. And if you're not into the characters and you want the show to be about something, well, tough luck. And it kind of rambles along through 80s nostalgia.
You want your show
and
to be about something in this economy?
I
spoiled assholes.
Just, I want that Soma.
Day,
I want that Soma entertainment.
Things, let alone Stranger Ones.
But wisely, I compare Stranger Things to the Da Vinci Code. That's what I keep thinking about when I think about this show. No, I was into. I read the Da Vinci Code back in the day. I was a page turner. I got to the end. I was enthralled. Little bits of information, mythology. In that case, like Christian mythology. In this case, 80s paranormal mythology.
80s pop culture mythology.
Yeah, and every. The last 5 minutes of every chapter, and Stranger Things goes by chapters, I guess because it's riffing on Stephen King books, ends with a big cliffhanger, and you want to know what happens next. And I think you could easily think that everything you just watched really matters. And I'm being
very
cynical.
That doesn't sound very movie-like to me, though. I mean, it sounds the way you're describing it.
Well, that's how they break it into TV. It has to be TV on a fundamental level. It is television. But the pacing of it is very movie-like, and which makes actually the kind of middle chunk and the conclusion a lot more enjoyable. But Dave, where do you fall in this? You're a much bigger Stranger Things fan than I am. I started off on a cynical foot. What do you think?
I mean, I guess I would almost argue the opposite of what you just said, which is Stranger Things 2 is a giving a lot of lip service to being like a movie-like sequel, but its failings are because it's aware that it's a part two and that there's going to be a part three. Like, not enough happens. By the time we get to the end, I feel like with the monster Will Byers family plot, we're like halfway through something. The Eleven story separates her from the group for the majority of the episodes, and I don't think we necessarily needed to see that. I feel like the argument is the structure of the series, if it did want to be like a movie, would be, you know, monster fight with all the kids combined with flashbacks with Eleven that sort of like explain things. So I feel like the big sidestep we take this season could have been her just disappearing and coming back, and we could have dealt with everything a little bit more neatly or not at all this season, because there are certain hanging aspects that make this season feel like nothing's resolved. The thing that was so nice about Stranger Things 1 is that it sort of felt like they were going for broke with this single monster 80s nostalgia story. And so, yeah, it kind of sucks that there was too many nostalgia callbacks, but I think the only reason those are watered down this season is because they're inartfully used this season. They didn't have the time to make Stranger Things 2 a nice little package that exists on its own. So I think it's definitely a TV series. I think there are episodes that benefit from being able to switch tonally very fast because it is just a different episode than the one that preceded it. And I think that there are things that they try that a movie would not try, or at least not leave as open-ended as this series does.
Well, Dave, you and I were talking offline about this season a bit and about how perhaps it has changed a lot, even in the short time that Duffer Brothers were putting it together, or maybe even while they were on set. It seems to have kind of shifted directions. And Katie and David and anyone listening who hasn't seen the show and may not be watching it, the gist of the story is that in the first season, this kid Will went missing. He went to the Upside Down. I'm sure you've heard about that. And now he was rescued, but he's still kind of infected by whatever was on the other side, the Demogorgon, the entities on the other side of this dimension. It's not really clear, and it's actually not really clear at the end of season two, but whatever the case is, you've seen that giant shadow monster in the trailers. He's having visions of it. It infects him. It enters him. It might be taking over him. And meanwhile, the government has a portal open, an attachment. They still have the Upside Down at their whim, and they're trying to prevent it from spreading by laying it on fire, and this is affecting kids, so everyone's freaking out. And
listen,
meanwhile,
if I wanted to focus on a government that has a portal open directly into hell, I do not need to fire up Netflix. Thank you very much.
Humor.
Zing, 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 zing.
And then
meanwhile, the Eleven character, who is obviously the most popular breakout thing of the first season,
what about
Barb? Kind of dealing with being in hiding. The sheriff character is kind of keeping her low key, keeping her powers, keeping her off the grid. But then she wants to go finding answers in a very like X-Men, I'm going to go, you know, find others like me kind of plot line, which only really develops. She leaves home one episode. She finds people in the seventh episode, which is the much discussed, reviled episode that people seem to hate because they depart the premise of the show, even though that's excellent. Like, get us out of the same old, and show us more of the world and show us more people in this world. I don't know. I don't understand the criticism there. But then she automatically comes back and, like, saves the day.
Is it a well-made episode? Because what I understood from the seventh episode is both that it's outside of the world of the show and just boring.
Well, it's not boring. It's just taking its time, like everything. Everything is, you
How
know...
How could you say it's not boring but not be, like, a huge fan of, like, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and The Flash?
Because it's one episode, yeah. And it's a change of pace. I'm saying that it's just as slow and you know, sloppily paced as any other episode, but at least changing up the scenery and changing up the premise and expanding the mythology and world is enough to pique my interest for 1 hour.
Do you think if Stranger Things had been an anthology series, which is kind of what I thought it might be after the first season, like, it would still be really good? Is it the staleness of the setting and the characters that's holding it back?
I think so, and this is what I wanted to ask Dave. My roundabout way, Dave, was like, so yeah, it was supposed to be an anthology series. It could always be changing it up. It could go broke for season one and then come back and do something completely different, be it riffing on some 80s movies and remixing that, or maybe playing with the same kind of mythology, like a Cloverfield type situation where you have kind of tenuous connections but in a totally different part of the world. But it chose not to do that. They, maybe for business reasons, decided to continue on with this story. And it seems very apparent to me that whatever they thought they were going to do in season two, when they, you know, famously, like a month after the show premiered, debuted the titles of the episodes of season two, they clearly had been starting to develop this idea, and then they changed all of a sudden. And, you know, this season has a huge...
The episode titles?
Yeah, they changed the episode titles, which seems totally fair, but it clearly changed the plotting at some point, too. Like, season two has a very big arc for two of the characters. It's totally boned these two actors. I'd be so annoyed if I were them. Like, they have to spend the whole time justice for Barb. It's all about figuring out what happened to Barb and, like, telling
who
her parents.
Who the fuck is Barb?
Barb is the breakout character from season one, David, the red-headed woman.
The red-headed girl with the glasses.
Yes.
I thought that Eleven was the breakout character from season one.
No, the
second you're contradicting yourself, Patches.
Sorry. I need tears of breakout. No, she was the mean character. Eleven was the breakout.
I cannot deal with this fucking show.
But Dave, answer my question.
Yeah.
Do you think this show totally reworked itself to a fault? Like, is it listening to fan chatter on Twitter? You know, everyone's wondering what happened to Barb, so suddenly this show has to be has to have an entire arc in season two about Barb.
Yes. If Stranger Things 2 would have been an anthology series, like I think they were planning to, until they stumbled across the kid actors and wanted to change it up. I think that was their initial plan. I think adapting to the kids, they also listened to a lot of what the fans had to say about the first season, to the detriment to the point where they had like a character respond to a recapping of the first season by being like, well, that's all a little derivative. You know, I wish it was a little bit more creative. I think little bits like that show that they're listening to the wrong parts of the audience, where I think if they were just like... I'm not, I don't hold this thing to like a high level of credibility. Like, if these kids meet a different monster every year, I'm fine with that. Give me like a Dracula season. I don't like care.
Like,
for me, it was always like, yeah, for me, it was always like the chemistry of the group of kids who are like brushing against the supernatural and finding kids' ways of dealing with it. That was what was charming to me about the first season. And the second season just doesn't seem to deliver on that as much.
Can we all agree that no matter how good the show is, and I'm getting the sense that it is not all that good, it cannot be worth having to sit through the fucking commercial with the kid talking about Mr. Peterson... And then sort of misogynistically, Peterson's wife about getting Fios 9,000 times every commercial break for every Rangers game.
Yeah, let's say this is what you get
game.
For watching sports instead of watching Netflix.
Dear Lord, Peterson's
there are no commercials
wife,
on
she
Netflix,
has
David.
A name, you dumb little fuck. Jesus Christ, I can't.
Well, you should see him on Stranger Things 2. There's a recurring gag where he makes a grrrr sound and he's talking about girls.
These
he's
poor
definitely
children.
Like... Indiana MRA, the worst he had ever played.
It's like he had a personality grafted onto him by whoever. I'm assuming it's that bad. The character in that commercial is similar to the character in the show and may not necessarily be similar to the personality of the little kid who plays him. It's robbery.
We were debating offline if Hawkins, Indiana, is in the more liberal part of Indiana, which definitely exists, or if it's in the more Republican. Now, there are signs outside in the first episode that say the family? The Wheelers are going to vote for Bush. So this seems like a dead giveaway that they are in a
for
kind
Bush.
Of Republican
For Bush? It's
patch.
Set in 88?
Oh, I'm sorry. In Reagan-Bush ticket. Reagan-Bush ticket.
I need realism in my political campaigns in this show.
we should wrap this up by saying, Dave, there are good things about this season. I want to put that out there. What are the good things?
I mean, I think for that one episode, it's a lot of fun. I mean, I watch a lot of television that's badly paced because they're making it from week to week. If I'm in the era where I'm getting something that's dumped binge watch, you know, they got to learn that their first acts are slow somehow. And it's just repetition at this point. It's very much like with Marvel movies. It's like they have a certain amount of latitude knowing that it's sort of like an unstoppable force at this point. There's going to be a Stranger Things 3. So I'm allowed to only focus on the things I like about Stranger Things 2 and not necessarily have to think about the things I didn't like again.
Hmm. Yeah, that's where the Netflix model pays off. And over the weekend, or maybe just at the end of last week, they announced that Olivia Colman was going to be playing the Queen on The Crown, which is a show that I like very much, in seasons 3 and 4. And season 2 hasn't even aired yet. So that...
Buckle up.
You know, definitely, yeah. It is nice that they can invest in these shows in multiple seasons to come, and hopefully that helps the creators. But
at least with The Crown, it's the literal opposite of Stranger Things, where it's like it was never going to be an anthology series. It never should have been. Like, the whole point is that you make it the same thing over time. Also, that casting news is awesome.
Yes, it is.
I need to quickly list the things I like about Stranger Things too, to appease the people who are now really mad at me for
after
getting
I've
on
sworn
camp.
At like the young child actor who stars in it. Yes, please.
Yes. Let me just say this: Sean Astin is in this season, and he is very good as Winona Ryder, who is horrible. Her like love interest in the show. He's so affable and funny. The guy who plays Steve Jokiri. He, you know, was a jerk in the first season by design, by, you know, cliche design. And now he is a human being who has to protect these kids. And he's so much better. It's like the character went completely. Actually, our colleague Chris Rosen had a great tweet about Steve. And he compared him to, who was Paul Schneider's character in Parks and Recreation?
Oh, Mark Brandanowitz.
Yeah, who like underwent a complete... Like, the characters, how they went underwent a complete transformation in the first season, second season. It's like, that's the kind of jump that Steve makes in this season. And I don't all the kids are bad except the kid who plays the main buyer's kid, who's Will. That kid was like off screen almost all of season one because he was trapped in the Upside Down. And now he's back and he has to do all this freaking out. And he's actually quite good in the show. So there's good things about Stranger Things, and Paul Reiser's in this season. He's good. The parts don't add up. It's not a coherent show, and it doesn't attempt to be either. I mean, Dave, we talk about the mythology all the time, and it's just like, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, and it doesn't try to. And when you deal with, like, nerd shit, Dungeons & Dragons references, and paranormal, you know, history and remixing it all, you gotta connect some dots, I think. You have to try a little harder. And especially if you're dealing with kids, and I just watched the Runaways screeners on Hulu, which everyone should definitely watch that show. That's a good show. That has characters and like momentum. Stranger Things, not so much. It's the dream.
For our mini segment tonight, we decided to call a little attention to some of the smaller movies that are, or at least one of them, that is beginning to platform out across the country. And it is a movie that has been making waves since it premiered at Cannes earlier this year. It is Sean Baker's follow-up to Tangerine, The Florida Project. The only positive association that Americans have been able to have about the state of Florida in a very long time, I think it's fair to say.
Although it does not make Florida look like a place that you want to go.
It is not a flattering portrait of Florida, but I'm glad this film exists all the same. It is not necessarily in the same vein as Tangerine, certainly aesthetically. This is shot in beautiful 35mm, although it had, rather than being shot on an iPhone like Tangerine was, but it has the same sort of energy to it. It is a story that focuses on not the same kind of poverty. I mean, poverty wasn't even the sort of the key, central idea in Tangerine, but it's the same sort of the margins of society. This is about the, I believe Sean Baker has referred to them, and this may be a more common term for these people who live in a rundown motel right on the fringes of Disney World, the invisible homeless who are very poor. They live in essentially the project, hence the title, but are not.
I actually know what the project, but anyway, the title means something else. But we
actually, please. I'm just fucking pulling this out of my ass. I still, to this day, think that they probably wanted to call it the Magic Kingdom, but didn't have the would have been sued into oblivion. And that is the name of the motel, I believe, where
Magic
the story
Castle.
Takes place. Magic Castle. Yeah. Wrong all over the place. Katie, why did they call it the Florida Project?
Well, so I got to see the movie on the big screen here, which is really exciting. It's going to open in North Carolina. It's in part of it is coming near me, I think, this week. But anyway, they did a special screening of it here. And the screenwriter and producer, whose name I don't know off the top of my head. So
Chris Bergotch.
Thank you. Yes, that's exactly who that was. He said that the Florida Project was Walt Disney's working title for Disney World. Like, that is what he called it before he came up with Disney World, which I thought. And then I think, you know, it definitely references the idea of, like, project housing. But I thought that was such a lovely meaning for it, that, like, it's hearkening back to the dream of creating Disney World.
That is a much better explanation than the one that I sort of cobbled together. but yeah, I mean, it's a story about this young mother and her even younger daughter, who is played by, I wish I had the IMDb page open in front of me, but I am very unprofessional and do not. I know that the girl who plays the little girl, her first name is Brooklyn Prince.
Yeah.
She is a riot. She is really wonderful. It is one of those unforgettable children's performances. It reminded me a lot of the little girl in a Jafar Panahi film called The Mirror, I think is the one that I'm thinking of. Anyway, if you've seen that for the, yeah, anyway, maybe that'll have some connection for you. But anyway, it's just about sort of their day-to-day life as they scrape by in this motel that is run by Willem Dafoe, who gives one of the really unforgettable performances, not just of this year, but of his career as a thoroughly, as a beleaguered but thoroughly decent man who struggles to show kindness to people to whom the world has not shown any, while also trying to maintain stability in this place that he runs. And he is not even the boss of bosses there, but he is a sort of middle management, runs the day to day. And it's just sort of about the hope or lack thereof that these people have, if there is any sort of upward mobility for them, all the various misadventures that the kids go on. And it's both, you know, sort of euphoric and deeply depressing at the same time, and ends on a note that we will not spoil, but manages to thread the needle, in my opinion, at least perfectly between the two. It's, I think, they're going to be one of the big stories this year, if it isn't already. Katie, did you feel the same way?
Oh, yeah. I was totally... charmed is the wrong word, because it's not, like, whimsical in that way, but it is about kids, and it's kind of, like, gives into their perspective and follows them. And I feel like I've talked about this on this podcast, that I'm usually firmly anti-child actor. Like, for the most part, I would rather they be replaced with CGI or not cast at all. But this movie...
Replaced by CGI?
Yeah. Harsh. Oh, yeah. No children. But this movie has kids who aren't really... acting, like, they're definitely acting, they were given lines, it's not a documentary, but it spends so much time following them at play and watching them make things up and kind of letting them improvise. And at the screening I went to, Christopher Bergesh talked about how they did that, and they, you know, have this beautiful script that tells the story, but there's this authenticness to it that is the key to the movie, and it makes it not obnoxious child actors, which I haven't seen Stranger Things 2, but I feel like that's part of the phenomenon, and that's just part of what makes it feel so thoughtful. And I think Tangerine did that too, is that you got Sean Baker, who's kind of putting his camera on these fringes of society, and that's a kind of thing that can often wind up being condescending when you're looking at, like, the horrible poverty these people live in. But I think that's the opposite of what he manages to do. He humanizes things, and he takes this, you know, the mother who's not a great mom by any stretch, but puts you in her perspective to the point that you see where she's coming from and why she makes the decision she does. It's a really empathetic film, maybe is the best word for it.
Matt or Dave, have either of you seen this?
I have not.
Unfortunately, no.
Actually, but I'm a big fan of Sean Baker and Chris Pagano.
Matt, what are you waiting for?
I would wait for time to allow me to go see it.
He had to watch all Stranger Things.
For some reason, this is the season of them showing us movies at like 4 p.m. every day. It's not good, but there's just so many movies.
Well, Florida Project is now out.
Yeah, and as David was saying, it's expanding all over the place. So I imagine, especially in New York, it's going to be playing for a long, long time. And it is really, I mean, Tangerine was famously shot on an iPhone and was gorgeous, but this, like you were saying, David, really takes it to another level. I was really glad I saw it on the big screen.
Yeah. An actual camera.
Yeah, it's definitely
level.
A big screen movie. It has a, as I said, the same sort of energy, although a little bit more of a refined aesthetic. I think, you know, A24 is putting this out. They are already in the process of putting it out. It's not quite the same cultural lightning rod that, that Moonlight was, but I think has a similar energy and ability to win people over, and I would not be surprised if it makes inroads in the award season in a similar, if less revolutionary way. But I do think that with the Oscars trending towards smaller films, as the film industry as a whole constricts a little bit, a movie like The Florida Project has a much better chance of getting that sort of attention and being bolstered as a result of it than it might have 3, 4, or 5 years ago. So look for it to continue to expand the smaller and smaller markets to find you wherever you may happen to be. If you're in the United States, I really don't know about the rest of the world, but definitely one of the best films of this year.
Seek it out.
And snow from the midnight sun where the hot springs blow.
So unless you're in Australia where it is killing at the box office, Thor Ragnarok comes out for you this Thursday night / Friday. It is the third entry in the Thor trilogy. It is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It is a bit different than the other Thor movies, which have been dour, I guess would be the nice way of saying it. It is directed by Taika Waititi of the Things We Do in Shadows and Flight of the Conchords fames, Hunt for the Wilder People. And he's applying his what he can to the Marvel formula and ends up shifting it more than other directors and certainly more than the previous Thor directors, Alan Taylor especially. Was unable to do anything.
Do we have any Dark World defenders on this podcast? Because they are out there.
I'm going to get ahead of myself, and someone could probably listen to our Thor Dark World review to confirm. I think I enjoyed Thor the Dark World, but all of these movies, I mean, this is going to be the thrust of my comment on Thor Ragnarok. They're all fine. They're all good. I enjoy them in the moment, and they have no weight whatsoever. I can't call Thor Ragnarok or Thor the Dark World good. They're just there. They are, as I tweeted earlier after seeing it, these movies to me at this point are like, they're not good. They're great antidepressants. You know, they just kind of like calm me. I referenced this earlier in the episode of calling Stranger Things like Soma, you know, the Brave New World Soma. That's how I feel. Ooh. I feel like I'm in a like meditative state watching these movies, and I laugh and I forget about the world. And okay, this just got really dark. Anyway, Thor the Dark World.
This sounds like the ideal blockbuster movie going experience.
I don't know if it is.
I think you're making it sound better than even you may intend to.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's not a totally positive take. I wish I could feel during these movies.
That's what I thought you were.
Well, I don't know if I would agree with Patches on the other Thor movies or even the other MCU movies, but I will agree on Thor Ragnarok that it does feel a little slight and it does feel a little weightless, and you are just sort of laughing with it and then it's over. And even though it may feel like it has some large consequences and you see some things on screen that alter things about the Thor universe, it's really more of a...
It's more
comedy,
like seven
cartoon.
Issues of a random comic book run.
Yeah, which is, you know, where all these things are coming from, yeah. Especially the Planet Hulk Gladiator thing. They've stripped that whole thing out of a Hulk storyline and inserted it here into a Thor storyline, but it actually works better here because you need Hulk to balance out Thor's, like, weird humor. It all works in a, I think, despite itself, Thor Ragnarok. I don't know why applying like 80s synths to the soundtrack and using some of that imagery works in a movie that's set in nonsense outer space with Norse gods.
Well,
but it's sort of
because like
does.
Rush
it's
album
like
covers are nonsense outer space, and that's the sense.
Yes, that's
this.
True. I think it went to the Hard Rock cover bypassing the Kirby a little bit more than something like Doctor Strange, which isn't to say that that stuff isn't here. It's just now it seems like Marvel's comfortable letting that being turned up to 11, which is good for things that are new and conceptually designed for that space, like Sakaar, the planet where he meets Hulk. But weird to keep seeing applied to something like Asgard, which was designed to be like this Shakespearean place of uptight white people, and we have to keep returning there like it means anything. So I think, you know, this movie doesn't shed all the problems of the Thor franchise,
although,
but it does manage to balance them out with entertaining moments.
The lesson of this movie is that nothing matters, and that not even Asgard has, you should put too much investment in Asgard, because Asgard's not a place, it's a people. That's the line they keep saying, and it can be moved around to anywhere.
Man.
Wait, should we briefly describe the plot of this movie for people like Katie who have not? You have not seen this movie.
Yeah, you've before
seen
everyone trailers. Accuses you guys of mansplaining talking over me, I have seen this movie. Oh, but David literally started talking over to me as I gave you a pass for talking over me. I haven't seen Thor Ragnarok. Please mansplain the plot.
I want to see David try
to
do this.
It's pretty simple. There's a guy, is Thor. And he goes home, and
it's 2 years after the Battle of Sokovia.
And then he finds his brother, and then they surprise have a sister, Hela, who is played by the great Cate Blanchett, who is totally wasted, unfortunately, figuratively.
But she looks amazing.
She looks incredible. But
it's a little baffling
she's
that she's
Hela.
Not in every second of this movie.
She is not in many seconds of this movie. She
sad.
Is Hela, the goddess of death. And she, for reasons that I could not tell you, really wants to do bad things. I don't know. She's like, I gotta do the bad things, and I'm gonna kill anyone who gets in my way. And they're like, you better not. And then they wind up in trash land, and they come back, and it's really dumb. Like, nothing happens, and nobody matters.
They go to trash land.
And it's eventually Tessa Thompson shows up playing someone who's actually wasted, Valkyrie, who is from
an old warrior
and
from
lives on, right, she lives on trash land, and she helps him. And
she's Han Solo of Trashland.
Yes, there's definitely a Han Solo vibe. And there are some nasty aliens, one of whom is voiced by Taika Waititi, who is a rock who speaks like a soft-spoken New Zealand gent, and he has a little alien friend who is constantly like laying eggs. It's disgusting.
he has saws for hands or something.
Yeah, it's in the battle arena. There's a really, really bad scene between the Hulk and
what?
That you've seen in the trailer ad infinitum. Between the Hulk.
Why do you think that's
now.
So bad?
Because it's just like, I think I say this almost every time we have one of these Marvel movies, but it seems no matter how much the technology might progress, like it becomes more and more true that on a long enough timeline, we will look back on all of the superhero movies the same way that we look back at the movies that were made in the 80s and 90s, the special effects, and be like, we just did not have the technology, but we certainly thought
we did. I was making somewhat
like
of an opposite
garbage.
Point before the podcast. It's not that. It's that it's I was making sort of an opposite
planet.
Point before the podcast is that like that we're at a point where this animation has been around long enough that you could have, you know, like physics simulations and you could amplify that to superhero things. You could have just like weird cartoon bubble people. The action in this movie is shot like heavy metal album covers, like cartoons. The Cate Blanchett kills everybody scene is cool, but sort of puzzling in the fact that if there was any real Cate Blanchett in there, it's not shot like there's any real Cate Blanchett in there. It's always interesting to me, like how, I mean, especially this year with the Twin Peaks, The Return being on, how we've absorbed how CGI works into our mind at a time that it was growing. So it's like we're peeking into like this uncanny valley that looks like something that's trying to imitate something that was off reference in the first place. It's always weird to me that they could like walk into a CGI studio and see all their physics machines and see like, you know, how a car could plow through a crowd of people, or see like 100 orcs, you know, take weird AI orders from themselves. But like the Hulk doesn't have a consistent weight. You feel like that would be something that was really easy to do, which implies that we're just honoring the visual over it, over the logic of it. I don't know where that gets us. It's fine from like moment to moment. Like I like the Hulk and Thor fight because I think it has a few good jokes and a few surprising action beats. But like, yeah, the way CGI is used in this movie and the way things are proportioned against each other really made me feel like I was watching more of a cartoon or reading a comic book than I was watching a movie.
It's funny that you're talking about special effects when you're describing it in this way, because I feel like your description just applies to the entire movie, right? That it's like they're always playing for the gag, or they're always playing for the setup to a big fight. There are no stakes, and no decision ever matters. You're not worried about any character at any time. Like and everything can be anticipated because it's a cartoon. You know, it's like such sitcom writing that, you know, Thor's going to break a window with a big bowling ball type thing. And no, it's not. It's going to hit the window and hit him in the head, and it's going to be a gag. And like you see those every single joke coming from a mile away.
Right. And it gets so exhausting. The same joke.
Every scene is
that
joke. It's
always the same joke, which is just that, like, the universe is at stake, and these are superpowered beings, and look, something dumb happens. It's and they're, like, made to look a little bit foolish and emasculated. It's always the same joke. It's the one strand of humor that they do. It was very funny when the Hulk punched Thor in the third act of The Avengers. It is no longer so funny. That is sort of counter to my big criticism with this movie and with the Marvel universe in general, which is that I actually think they should go more cartoonish and more slapsticky, if anything, because these movies are afraid to commit to genre. I mean, they bring in someone like Taika Waititi to make a Taika Waititi movie, and not necessarily in the vein of what we do in The Shadows, but something that has that sense of humor that is unambiguously a comedy. And it does have some of his signature humor in a way that the other Marvels do not, and you cannot deny that, but it is still belongs to one genre and one genre only, and that is the Marvel Cinematic Universe genre, which is sort of a very lame and staid hero's journey thing unto itself with a lot of bright colors around it. And all of the detours into anything else are exactly that. They're just detours. They are minor asides into, you know, whatever flavor the director might bring to it. But when somebody, you know, it's not quite as bad as you get with Star Wars, where they'll just fire you if you, you know, deviate from whatever the vision is. But Star Wars is a much smaller beast in a lot of ways. I mean, this is all these individual things. And I think that the future of the Marvel movies is to really lean into genre and like have a movie that's just an out and out comedy. Have a movie that is a horror entry. Have a movie that is actually a heist movie.
How can you say that this movie is not an out and out comedy? I really don't understand that criticism.
It's because it's the same fucking beats as every other Marvel movie. They're just tweaked a little bit
more.
But
like, where could
the funnier? The bass is lowered. The reverb is picked up. I mean, I just think that they're all the same thing about someone coming and big lasers, and they're trying to take over a planet, and there's a big fight, and then this happens, and now we're at the trash land. It's like, it's all the same. We've seen it a million times before. Why not just have a movie that's about, like the Happy Gilmore route? It's about saving Asgard from greedy developers. It doesn't need to be about them, like, blowing the planet up. It doesn't need to be about like the prophecy and the goddess of death. It can just be
to
a
take
little story
worlds,
that allows
the
characters
to
do this.
I mean, there's obviously a business concession there, so that's one thing. But the second thing
is there?
I'm not
why
sure
not
that
make
would
a $40 million Marvel movie that will still gross $120 million rather than like $350. And it can just be a smaller entry. It's a lot bigger and shinier than what you see on their ABC or Netflix shows. But it can also lean harder into genre. I guess.
That's just not what I was taking away from this movie, the faults of this movie for me. I mean, I was laughing at the jokes. I think the parts that are just like supposed to be comic banter between Hemsworth and Ruffalo as both regular Hulk and man Bruce Banner, and that riffing can be very funny. And when they finally get together as a group, which doesn't come soon enough, it feels like a real slog till Hemsworth and Ruffalo and Tom Hiddleston as Loki and Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie, they're all together trying to solve a problem. Like, that's funny when there's a team aspect, but it takes so long to get there. And like Jeff Goldblum, how can you say this movie's not funny? He's just like making faces.
I did not say it wasn't funny. I said that it wasn't an out and out comedy. Okay. It's a Marvel movie with comedic elements, but I really would have preferred a comedy that made use of the Marvel universe.
I don't know if you can get much funnier than this movie, or at least, yeah, maybe just need to abandon the action scenes and abandon that.
I laughed out loud, never.
But I think David's also talking about the structure of a comedy rather than the structure of a Marvel movie. Like, there's a way that a comedy unfolds its story that is something that I was also kind of hoping that they would lean into more here, but
Katie,
you know,
I think
the movie constraints are pretty intense.
Well, what do you mean by the structure of a comedy? Like, what does that mean? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't think that what David's talking about aspiring to is out of reach. But if we take something like Avengers: Age of Ultron and Thor: Ragnarok, Marvel's obviously learned that allowing something to be free of its mythology and just have some of its characters to fuck around with virtually no consequences is going to be beneficial to it. I think, sure. I also hope they're learning that like these like single origin movies have to distinguish themselves a little bit more, but we aren't actually going to know where we are because we're still locked in this pattern, this pre-2012 pattern that was foreseen. And so Thor Ragnarok was never going to be the movie that was going to be allowed to be something else.
Yeah, but...
I'm surprised it's the movie that was allowed not to have an Infinity Stone in it. But, like,
There's an Infinity Stone in it.
Okay, there's an Infinity Stone in it, but it's not the central MacGuffin, which, if you would have asked me after, you know, Avengers, how they were going to roll this out, it was going to be planting these tiny MacGuffins in these other movies so we'd all get together for the team-up movies.
I would say
they've decided to let the team-up bleed out.
I cannot believe these words are coming out of my mouth, but credit to Taika Waititi. The most satisfying moment in this entire movie involves an Infinity Stone.
Wow.
Wait.
Is Thanos in this shit?
What moment are you talking about?
It's, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen it and cares. I'm talking about a moment very early in the film. Scrub forward 20 seconds. It's when Kate Blanchett walks by the Hall of Treasures in Asgard, looks at an Infinity Stone, and is like...
No, that's the Infinity Gauntlet.
Aren't there Infinity Stones?
I don't think there are right now.
There's one. There's the Tesseract.
But you're not.
She's impressed by the Tesseract.
Yes, but you're talking about when she pushes over the Infinity Gauntlet.
All right,
it's different.
Take it back.
It's different.
This movie has no good moments. And may God take mercy on us.
The one thing I wanted to say. I was just gonna say we're talking about the comedy here, and that maybe it could have pushed further. But what I liked about the Thor movies is the dynamic between Hemsworth and Hiddleston, Thor and Loki. They have the most interesting relationship in the Marvel universe, and Loki's always been the best bad guy because he's somewhat dimensional. And he totally wasted this movie. He has no character whatsoever. He has no path. Everything before this movie is forgotten because, I don't know, they're deeply ashamed of Thor and Thor the Dark World. They keep changing course and they can't remember the past. I don't understand why they have to do that. These movies aren't bad. They're just shifting gears. But you have the history of these two characters and it's completely erased in Ragnarok. Why don't you do something with those characters? And then, as we were saying earlier, why don't you do something with Kate Blanchett as Hela? Make her important to the galaxy. Why isn't she the big bad of this entire mega franchise?
We have a special guest. It's not Reed Hastings. It's the next best thing. Joanna Robinson.
Whoa.
How did this happen? Hi, guys.
Joanna, your thoughts on Thor Ragnarok. Go.
I don't know. I really hate to bust Patch's mid-rant about how Kate Blanchett was apparently wasted.
No, my rant was over. But if you my rant, I will be very happy.
I think Kate Blanchett is like sort of one of the less essential parts of the movie for sure.
That's the problem.
I don't know that it's a problem because Marvel villains are rarely satisfying, right? And so it's much more fun to watch, like, Hiddleston do his Loki thing on a minor level of betrayal than it is for to watch any big grandstanding villain make big proclamations, you know? So
this is like when Doctor Strange rolls into the Thor movie.
No, but I liked Dr.
Strange. Joanna on this podcast.
So. Well, I don't know if you already talked about this, but I really did not like the Doctor Strange movie, and I liked Doctor Strange in this movie.
I concur with that. Well, I like him in this movie more than I like him in the Doctor Strange movie, but I still feel like it's out of place. Like, it doesn't connect to anything. It's one issue of a comic book in an 8-issue run of this movie, and it's so fleeting. I don't like all the sensory overload because it doesn't stick for me. I don't want to walk out feeling like I just spent 2 hours eating cotton candy.
I did like the Doctor Strange movie. I struggle with him, his one brief scene towards the beginning of this movie, because there was some connective tissue missing between what I remembered of the character and how powerful he was in just, you know, walking around his house in New York in this movie. I understand that he is maybe the most powerful of all the Avengers. I read some listicle once that I remember. but I missed that part where he became God. And that sort of threw me for a loop.
Wait, is he literally a god? Isn't that the point?
Oh, Thor is a god, but...
No, I mean, but Dr. Strange... Not,
yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Wait, Dave, quickly, rank the most powerful Avengers. Go.
The most
number one,
powerful
Vision, right?
Avengers. Yeah, Vision's yeah. Probably number one. See, I don't know. Strange might be good number three. And then I would say Hulk's number two.
Hulk?
Yeah.
Not Scarlet Witch, who can, like, alter perception.
Hulk is just strong and green. Doctor Strange is, like, time and space and... shit.
I'm just talking about characters that could potentially actually fight a god. Those three.
This is what happens when David Ehrlich like dials me into a Fit Were podcast. Is I was like, let's do listicles, guys.
Wait, but I know I'm really struggling with this because like the Hulk is like running at Doctor Strange in this hypothetical scenario. Let's say they're fighting in the arena, and Doctor Strange, from what
just opens a portal.
Exactly, from what I can glean from his appearance in this movie, opens a portal and the Hulk is sucked into another dimension, never to be heard or seen again.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful.
Doesn't it depend on like what Doctor Strange is wearing at a given time?
Oh, wow. To access. Oh, yeah, because he needs the eye.
He needs that time stone, baby.
Eye of Amagato, thing, right? Or whatever.
Bracelet? Is that what he wears?
No, he has the Eye of Agato.
But what is he wearing? Like, what is the thing he's physically wearing in his body to make himself powerful?
A necklace.
He does have bracelets. No, he does have like power bracelets that open his portals, his mini portals. It's not a very powerful bracelet.
What about his power brooch?
More of a slap bracelet.
Does he have a power earring or like a nose ring of some sort, a piercing that we should know about?
It's a belly button ring.
Please feel free to kick me off this anytime you guys want. I'm so sorry that I
also has a magical tramp stamp.
I love that David added you, and now we're having like a fifth grade lunch conversation about who the most powerful Avenger are, which is like the last thing I would expect David to talk about.
A more appropriate Marvel movie for our conversation about it to descend into a fifth grade lunch conversation.
I love Thor Ragnarok, guys. I love it.
Can I get real for 1 second? Can I ask you a serious question? I'm going to take this conversation like to the pits, if you don't mind.
There's one scene
in the movie that stopped me dead in my tracks. I don't know if we talked about this off podcast. People I sit in a chat room all day with. One scene that just made me like stop and be like, I hate this movie. Ooh. For the second. And do you know what scene that was?
No, I don't.
There's a scene where Carl Urban, who plays a new character named Scourge, he's an Asgardian warrior. He's like in the beginning of the movie, he's showing off to some girls. He's standing at the Bifrost, the rainbow bridge, and he's like, I've gotten some artifacts from Earth.
Wow. Yeah.
And he pulls out two assault rifles.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And he's like, look at my guns, they're awesome, I got them from Texas. And I'm like, okay, that's weird. And that really made me kind of uncomfortable, I have to admit. And then later in the movie, during like the big action climax,
you should try going to Texas. It's very, very.
Yeah, he's open carry in Asgard, apparently. In the end of the movie, he actually has because he kind of sides with Cate Blanchett during the movie, and he becomes bad. But then he decides to have one last bit of good, and he's gonna plow through some goons, faceless goons. But he whips out the two assault rifles and he starts shooting people. I thought I was deeply uncomfortable by this. It reminded me of John Wick Chapter 2, which, yeah, you know, is a movie full of gun violence. I should have a whole problem with this movie if I'm getting with the two assault rifles shooting. But that movie didn't make me uncomfortable until he name dropped the AR-15. And then I was like, whoa, over the line. It got like too real. And this movie, and someone was talking to me about it that, Taika Waititi he's kind of like a guy. Like, he likes toying around with, I think they do that in Hunt for Wilder People. They get like big guns.
Yes, and that's because in New Zealand, they don't have a problem with mass shootings.
No, this is exactly right, that they can make it. But here in Thor, it made me very uncomfortable. And I wondered if anyone else was
saying it's that. Not here in Thor, it's there in Thor. This is a movie shot in Australia, set in another planet, where they do not have this problem, and guns can be laughed at. Guns also are one of the least powerful weapons I think anyone has ever brought to Asgard, rather than
they
the
work. There's a lot of violence in this movie too. I should say a lot of people get shot or like impaled and thrown off things, and it didn't faze me at all until Carl Urban's there shooting people up with assault rifles.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with you being uncomfortable with this, because I think if anyone is ever uncomfortable with guns in this country, it is a positive thing. But it did not bother me because it
Disney
because
movie.
Of the cartoonish context. Disney movie, please.
The introduction of the guns bothered, like, because whenever I saw it, it was like, right, it was just really very fresh with the Vegas shooting. And the introduction of the guns like did sort of put a chill through me, but since his character is supposed to be so terrible at that point, it sort of felt like part and parcel of this terrible character who is obviously going to break bad, you know, sort of thing. And then I had forgotten about that chill by the time the action scene came, because as David just said, the violence is so cartoonish at that point that, you know, we're just, you know, Mark Ruffalo can fall out of a plane onto his face and nothing happens to him. So, you know, it's like it doesn't matter. We're in Looney Tunes territory now.
But there's still those, there's still guns. Everyone's shooting lasers at them.
To defend the I guess director and production as much as possible, I would not be surprised if that was a mandate, because one of his more popular appearances in the comics is with those exact guns. So it might have been something that Scourge had to have. He had to have the axe and he had to have the guns, and he has them both in this movie.
I also don't know if our entertainment should be beholden to the NRA and the atrocities that are committed in this country. I think it's a larger conversation, but I know. As I said, I totally I'm here for your right and your feeling to be uncomfortable. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I don't hold that against the movie. And obviously there had been any number of mass shootings in the world, and particularly in the United States, before the one that happened after they had already locked picture on this film. But I couldn't tell who it was, but someone was about to speak.
I think it was Joanna.
Oh, no.
See, I brought it down. We should probably end by talking about Jeff Goldblum.
Wait, I want Joanna to talk, because Joanna loved this movie. I feel like we haven't had that perspective on it. And
wait, let me set her up. Joanna, can you talk about – we were talking about genre a little bit, and I would love to hear your thoughts about this. We were talking about – Patches was saying the movie is very cartoonish, and I was saying that I really wanted the movie and the Marvel Universe in general to lean harder into genre to better differentiate the various installments. I wish that this had been even smaller stakes and not fallen into the usual hero's journey stuff and been even funnier. And Patches said that he thought the Marvel movies were a little bit more differentiated than I do. Where do you stand?
I think they're getting there. I think they're on the path to where you want them to be. And I think stuff like, you know, they call Spider-Man Homecoming their John Hughes movie. I think Black Panther is going to feel very, very different. You know, and so this to me does feel like a Taika movie. But that's not quite a genre, right? But I almost think that if they hadn't locked themselves into calling it Thor Ragnarok, it's possible that we wouldn't have gotten any of that, you know, Cate Blanchett stuff, that we could have just set it on the Jeff Goldblum trash world and done that instead. I feel like that's the kind of realm that Taika is most comfortable in telling his stories. And from what I know of this movie and of the whole idea behind it, which you can see when you watch it, is that it was just sort of like rip up all the Thor that came before it, like quite literally, right? They break the hammer, they cut his hair, they rip the cape, they kill his friends, like bye-bye old, they blow up Asgard, like bye-bye old Thor, we're done with it, we're going to do this instead.
Oh, that reminds me, how good was Zachary Levi in this movie as Fandral?
For his 2 minutes?
Not even that. I think he appeared, I think Cate Blanchett shows up at the Bifrost and shoots him in the heart with a dagger and he dies.
Damn.
Good scene. It was really funny. And Anthony Hopkins is great in this movie, like having fun doing comedy Odin for a bit, you know, like I was really, because I've been so entirely bored by Anthony Hopkins in every Thor movie. And then when this movie starts with him, Loki in disguise as Odin, so you get to see Anthony Hopkins doing Tom Hiddleston doing Odin. It's delightful.
Did Renee Russo die at some point?
Yeah, she died in
the second one.
Yeah, in the Dark World. Mm. So anyway, I was arguing with my sister about this because she saw Spider-Man Homecoming and she really didn't like it. She was angry that she felt like she had to have seen Civil War in order to appreciate, and she resented that because she didn't see Civil War. She was really angry about it. And she was driving home to me this idea that we now grade all these superhero movies on the scale. So if our boundless enthusiasm for Spider-Man Homecoming has something to do with the fact that Spider-Man hasn't been super fun for a little while, and the same is probably true of Thor. Thor has always been a sore spot for me, and I'm like, oh, I feel like they finally figured it out. So maybe that's why I like it so much. But also the Taika of it all, obviously.
I would bet a good bit of money that, I think there is going to be, Chris Hemsworth is not as done as like Chris Evans is done. Impression.
I think there's going to be more Hemsworth would be my guess. I don't know that. I don't have any insider information. But just based on the way that they talk about the future, like we know some Avengers aren't coming out on the other side of Infinity War. And by the way they talk about it, I feel like Hemsworth might be on the other side, like that he's really excited.
It certainly sounds like Taika wants to come back and do it again, because he, despite my criticisms of the movie, he has said that, and this is, it sounded to be genuine and not just like that thing that you say because you're being trotted out of the studio, was sort of left to his own devices enough. He wasn't Colin Trevorrow, or I don't know, that's a bad example, but
Gareth Edwards.
He wasn't Gareth
Edwards. The guy who got fired off of Han Solo.
Perfect,
yes.
Yeah. I have to run because I'm actually on Skype to do another podcast and they just tried to call me. So it's been nice guest starring like Dr. Strange on your Fitwear, and you guys are the best.
Jump back into
Ladies and gentlemen, Joanna Robinson.
Bye-bye.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. Thank you so much for listening. Please leave us reviews on Polish iTunes or any iTunes. And then if it is in a foreign iTunes, tweet at us so that we know that you sent it. And you can find out how to do that. In the meantime, tell the people who you are. I lost track. I got off of my usual script.
I am Matt Patches on script here, executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes and share them and leave comments and we'll read them. Leah.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm a senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire. Leave us reviews. The more reviews you leave, the less I'll talk. Everybody wins. And the more, maybe I will randomly Skype in various people on my Skype Rolodex. Some good ones in there. None better than Joanna, of course. But who knows? Also, find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, DA7E, where you can find me on Twitter. You can find the rest of us also on Twitter. That's actually Katie's thing. See, Katie, I'm also not on script.
Hey!
It's not just you.
I threw you off.
Actually, this week on Storm of Spoilers, we're going to do a mailbag. It's my other podcast. You can also find it at fightingintheworm.com. Answering some of your questions. And then next week, if you liked Joanna talking about Thor Ragnarok, we're going to do it again. And then also make her talk about the greater MCU. So check that out, Storm of Spoilers.
Will you guys finish the conversation of all the strongest Avengers? Like, go down, like, all, like, 25?
Just for you, Katie.
Yeah! I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, and I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H, and we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where you can tell us that you left us a review, or maybe just answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Thor Ragnarok, what movie villain should have been Kate Blanchett?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.